Mr. Mann, Reel 13. You were talking about the way in which you personally handled the dead and the wounded of the time. What happened to the personal effects which a dead man may have on him? Did you search him?
The personal effects, if you went into action, you didn't have to have anything on your person that could identify you or your regiment or any liquor or soda. So basically, apart from your identity discs, you've no playbook record with you, personal letters you weren't allowed to carry, you didn't use have a diary or anything like that. Basics, it was your equipment and your identity discs. As regards personal effects, you may have had a chain or something, or a ring on your finger, or a watch. And I think that would be about the limit of your more or less burden, or a pocket knife in your pocket, something like that, that was of no intelligence use to the enemy. In the event of a soldier being killed, these personal effects explained about the identity disc. One was left with him when he was buried, and the other one was collated with, say, a watch ring or whatever it might be. And back at the battalion, his other personal effects would be taken out of his kit, which had been left there before going into action. And the padre used to do a lot of collating. And the commanding officer would write to the soldier's nearest relative, like it was. In your playbook, there was A, B, Army Book, Part 1 and Part 2. Part 1 and Part 2 was solely for your rates of pay. The other part, it detailed your more or less medical information and particular heights, weight, this, that, and the other, what size clothes you took and all that. And there's also a page in this, I think it was a part two, which was your form of will. And this was made out in the early days of your training, actually. And this was made your will out, which is just a case of, whatever I believe to my parents, in my case. That was retained by the records office, I would think, not there. But the personal effects were, as I say, with the padre, the commanding officer, and they would eventually be sent to the nearest relative who was nominated in the will.
Did you see or know of any unpleasant situations where personal effects, rings and watch and so on, were taken from a dead man by whoever was looking at him, attending to him?
I can't say that. No, I mean, the time, even the stretcher bears, you would maybe remove something from the dead person, but you would hand it in when you got back to the IT. But I think the lads were honest enough in that way, from my experience, to say. Of course, if it was somebody who had been killed in action, and say we'd have to fall back and actually the Germans would come across them and they would, some of them would be mostly, others they had as much support as what we had. You get good and bad in any nationality. So.
Was there any situation whilst you were stretcher bearing that you had to give injections, or were you allowed to give injections?
The only one was morphine, which you could give, and if it was just something similar to what the modern day flu jab is, just put it in. But if you'd given a wounded soldier morphine, you would put a letter M on his forehead. The letter M that was put in with your finger dipped in his blood and the M marked on the forehead. In the event of having to put a tourniquet on, you would have to put a T on his forehead as well, which necessitated the tourniquet being released for 15 minutes or so, or whenever possible, just to inform somebody there was a tourniquet on the person. That was it. And that was the case. It did did that if it was necessary on the field, and then getting back to the regimental aid post, the medical officer there, and he would carry on from there with his medical attention. And then he would get an ambulance come up. Some of the ambulances, remember, they were driven by American volunteers, and they would come up to the first aid post and then take the wounded back to a hospital or to be transported further afield, taken out of the area.
So you must have experienced some very unpleasant wounds and unpleasant sights. How did you cope with those?
You could, in a nutshell, there could be arms or legs hanging off, or people you couldn't even identify through the wounds. It's funny, you get a dead soldier. Remember one case where he got into a haystack, this soldier, and then we'd been shelled on that, and they come to move, and he didn't go out the haystack. And it was a haystack built like a big cone shape, like a pole in down the middle of it, and then it was cone shaped, the hay around it. And we pulled him out, and he was dead. And the funny thing was that there wasn't a piece of straw moved from this haystack. And the men have said it had been the blasters that killed him. Mm-hmm. But there were some terrible sights, nothing you could do. You can see limbs hanging off, and he was only hanging by the skin. What could you do?
When you pick up a wounded man who was still conscious, what was there invariably a question, like, you know, am I all right, or something like that he asked you as you picked him up?
Probably depend on the state of the injury. I mean, he could maybe have been hit by a bullet somewhere. Might class it as just a flesh wound, and it class it as a looking one. It will no doubt feel some pain and that, but some could even say, I've got a looking one. Or there would be another case of where somebody was wounded, he more or less knew that he had it. It could be in tears as well, which is only natural.
Is there amongst the very severely wounded, or those that thought they were, was there a cry for a parent? You know, were they crying for the mothers, or which you often do?
So when the time we got back to the first aid, well, it could be delirious talking. You'd have to be restrained, but it was just the condition that we're in. The luxury, of course, that you got if you were wounded or taken back to a first aid post was that a cup of hot sweet tea, which was supposed to be good for you. This, of course, was just brewed up onto a primer stove. Maybe the primer stove, which was only a sip. And it, of course, depended on the injury. If it might have been wounded in the stomach and that, you wouldn't give him a drink.
Was the blighty wound looked forward to by the men as a means of getting out of it all?
Well, I'm just speaking from my own thoughts, but I suppose if a chap got a blighty wound, he would consider himself lucky in some sense. But there again, if it was a blighty one and he'd lost a limb, well, were you lucky? Or was it nice to, well, I suppose you still had your life, and at the same time, you were disabled for lifetime. Sort of a situation, live or die, I suppose, which way you look at it. But even though men go into the line, and there's one member in particular, he says, you know, he said, I don't think we're going to come out this time, and they don't talk to me, so he, you know, and he hasn't come out. He just had a premonition. I mean, this isn't regular, but I have actually known it. I'm saying, I don't think I'll be getting out of this. I really didn't. Once had a reinforcement come up, we'd been in the Durham's, and we're in the village when he joined us. And I recognised him, called him Charlie. Not the PT structure was. my company. And he said, what's it like up there and all that? So, jokingly, I said, it's not so bad, it's somebody with you there. I said, get in one of these houses. And I said, tear up a bit of a white sheet. There was nobody living in this place there. Tear up a bit of a white sheet and show it in your back of the restaurant. And I said, if they get too close, you just give it a good wave. I said, he's going to be all right. Henderson, they call him, McHenderson. And the funny thing was that we went into action and I've never seen him again. I've heard him since. And I just said it in a joking sort of sense, you know. I said, all right, right, make a white sheet and give it a good wave. If they're getting too close, you'll be all right. But what happened to him, I don't know to this day, but he never come out of that action. No.
Did you experience men who just snapped, couldn't go forward or couldn't go back?
There was one particular lad, Hart, they called him, Harry Hart, and he was a small bit of chap, and he had my blondly wavy curly hair. And they were after a shattered attack, he just broke down. Just crouched down there, and well, in the farmhouse at the time, this was in the medical section as well, he had been a stretcher bearer. And he'd just gone all together, you couldn't console him or anything. He cried and cried and cried, and he was evacuated out, like taken back. That was just a shell shock. Also seen many a man cry with just the conditions and that, the nerves had started to go or had gone all together. There was nothing that could be done, they just shut. Which I think gets back to the First World War, where there's been a lot recently about men being executed, and really they've been suffering from shell shock. Having seen it myself, I quite understand it. I couldn't understand the shooting of them. They said they only shot them in the First World War to give an example so that other men didn't desert or anything.
And this must have been a gradual build-up of pressure within a person, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Nobody looked forward to going into the line. Usually before you went up without a party, as best you could, if you got noticed beforehand, if it wasn't an emergency going into the line, you'd try not to do a party. One like to water car boys, they were about 10 gallons, and they would be full of vino. Once this was the night before we would go up, and they put a picture show on it, but it was kind of an orchard we were at the time, and the big screen was put there. I remember drinking this vino out of me one pint tin, and the amyl mug, and we went. I remember seeing the screen when we got to that position, and the next thing I remember was waking up the next morning. I was under a mosquito net, and by what a blooming head I had, we were moving up to the line that day. That was a right hangover. But saying, going back to when you said what sort of rations did they bring up, and that one thing which I didn't mention was in the cold weather and that in that. They would send up a bottle of rum. And one occasion, I remember that coming up, and old dog the platoon, there were only about two or three of us would drink it, so we had a right good sip of that. That was up there.
Did you experience men in action or going into action who were actually drunk?
No, I wouldn't say drunk. I mean, this rum would come up. This particular incident that I just mentioned, I know we were feeling merry and maybe a bit light-headed after it, but I can't say I've seen a man go into action really drunk, you know, out of his head. You'd maybe see an odd man lose his head altogether and run for some reason to a point. Whether it was an advantage point or whatever, he would get up and run. He never really understood, but that was a dangerous thing to do in the line, because there were some good snipers. I remember once we were on the skirt of a mountain top, going in the mountains, and you couldn't dig in because the ground was just like rock, and actually built up a sand around you. And this chap, he got his sand built round him. Jerry was a bit high up the mountain to give a bit of cover during the night. And he had his back on his back, and also that was in front of him. And during the next day, he put an arm forward to go over the stones and that to get into his pack in front of him. The bullet went through his elbow. And his other hand immediately went to his elbow, and he got another bullet through it. And that was 10 wives.
Were there situations where even your leading officers cracked under the strain of going into action?
I can't say I've been where an officer's cracked. An officer was once wounded, I know, was treating him, and he gave him his revolver. I just took it into me for the rest of the hours there. I remember him saying, he says, "Oh, I shan't be needing this now." He wasn't really badly wounded, but he got him in the leg. And anyhow, bandaged him up, and I didn't actually take him back on that stretcher. I just bandaged him and took more stretcher bears, took him away. But with an officer cracking up, there was a Major Montgomery, no relation to Field Marshal Montgomery there, but Montgomery they called him. And he used to go into action with his forage cap on, not his tin hat, and his walking stick. And his revolver was still in its holster. And when he came to move forward, his right advanced, and he went walk for it, and he never even got wounded, like the time that he had been in there. But he was a real old soldier, because when you were out, it's like during my time as an infantry man, he used to give you training. He always said, "Get your pack on and double up this hill, training." And it was nearly worse in an action. But you were fettled if you did it, and if you didn't do it to his satisfaction, it would get you arrested and then make you do it again. I would not go at it and tell you to get yourself fit if you paid the mess of it. But in action, he was a leader, definitely a leader. That's all. He went in with his walking stick and his pistol. I don't remember him drawing it. No, because I wasn't with him all the time, of course. Just what went on.
Good officers, what would you say made up a good officer from the infantryman's point of view?
Well, a good officer was sort of this one called a real soldier who appeared to be fearless. And I suppose really an officer, the more he was for discipline, the more a man would, I suppose, follow him. I think if you were under discipline for an officer, you had a tendency to follow that officer more so than if an officer was say, gentle with you and that. You think, he won't say anything, no. If it was a discipline officer, you would follow him, because you were in for it if you didn't.
Is any officers other than the gentleman you've mentioned who stand out in your memory as being good frontline soldiers?
Well, you get a variation with officers. I remember one occasion when the line and a sniper opened up, and a bullet, it must have passed within very few inches of my head and smacked into the bank behind me. I remember this was in the trench, which is in the bank. I remember it slapping into the woody pasture, and I was on a Bren gun at the time, and this officer shouted, "Fix the Bren on that sniper." And you know, I didn't put my head up, to tell you the truth, I didn't put my head up there. And he said to another one that was in the section, "Give me a rifle." So I got the rifle and he started running, I remember saying this, running back of those bushes or about and that, but look at you, you couldn't see there was trees and bushes, a sniper could have been anywhere there, so I was going to try and put a Bren gun on him, what do you think? He says, pass me that rifle, so one of them gave me a rifle, he said, I'll get him, and he hadn't been gone, I should think, what, a couple of minutes, and they come back, and it was the nearest touch I bet he'd had, across his face here, a bullet had scarred it, not across his face.
On the top of his cheek.
He his bloody heads down. But give him credit, he went to have a go to see, but by God, he was sharp back in his slit trench. And
do you remember his name?
No, I can't remember his name. I can see him to this day, but I can't remember. I remember him saying, fix that bread on that sniper. And there was a yoke. Just kept the head down. That was pretty like. Oh, I'm going to pick that up. I already had this bullet come near enough to me. And I thought, if I get a bit more, I know what's going to happen here.
Was there a great deal of understanding amongst you if one of your comrades snapped under the pressure?
Well, you're in trouble. I never had a trench mate, a slit trench pal with me or went under the weather. Well, there's some cases they have been, and they would just send him back, had to go back. And if one cared, they would get a stretcher for that, take him back so far, come him back. We say with it as well, you would get men aim and shoot, but if you wounded somebody, whichever side it may be, if he was wounded, a wounded man had to be looked after. Now if you killed a person, he didn't need anybody to look after him. So really, in a sense, the more you could really wound, I should say, was going to tie up more people behind there to look after them. Just one of these things as well.
So you're with the medical unit. What happened to you next?
I was in the medical unit. That was to Anzio when I came out of the medical unit into D Company.
Had Gigliano, the River Gigliano, come before Anzio?
Yes.
So you were with the medicals when this action took place, were you?
When we landed at Anzio, I was still medical. And within a few days of that, I was put into D Company as an infantryman. So I had to hand the Red Cross armband in and medical. But it was a bit desperate situation then, because not only was I put as an infantryman, there was even other drivers, even some cooks as well, they were sent up to hold the line because it was a precarious position. It was touch and go whether we would hang on or have to go back.
Before we come to that, what happened to you that caused you to be moved into the Anzio invasion?
As I mentioned earlier on a previous tape, that the 56th London Division was part of the American 5th Army, and when it comes to the Anzio landings, an emphasis was put on to the Americans landing at Anzio, but there were actually British troops as well. There was the Queen, the Oxen Bucks, and then the Green Howards came in as well after that. So it was a combined operation really. But from the Grigliano, as I said, we're taken down to this port, put on the boats, and then we had to do a landing at Anzio. The beachhead itself, it wasn't really a difficult landing. It was flat, very flat. And from what I've learned since, of course, that the Germans weren't really in an opposing strength for a landing. So they fell back, I should think, roughly about 10 miles or so into Anzio, to the slightly higher ground and uneven ground, what is in that? So So we sort of got onto the landing all right, but once you got towards this higher ground, well then the Germans had the advantageous positions.
Had they told you where you were going when you got on the boats?
Not until we were actually on the way there, yeah, shortly before we landed. Of course, it was only hours, but it wasn't 2 or 3 days or anything like that. It was just hours on the boat, and then we said, we're doing the landing at Ramsey.
Was this the usual type of landing craft that you were on?
The ones that we were on was dropped down at each side of the boat, not the small landing craft, although they were used, but there was these steps going down the side of the boat, because we had the truck inside the boat, it was transport as well. So the infantry made the initial landings, and then as soon as possible we were in after them, following them through. We got the truck, and then as I say, well, we got off with the truck, and the landing troops, with very small resistance against them, and were advancing, and we were following advancing, we come to a wooded area on the left, and then when we got there, the American troops came on the left of us, and they started digging like I don't know what, and they had cutting trees down to put over the chops and the dugouts and all sorts, whereas we just were under our canvas, the 2 men little tents and dug your holes in, and for the trucks we had to dig out so that it would allow the truck to run forward into this hole so that the engine was covered by the ground, as though it was in a trench, and the back wheel would be stuck out on top. Of course, there was a lot of shelling went on there. And also at Anzio, there was a park called the Crossover. And that this crossover, which was a railway line going across the bridge. And on this railway line, the Germans had a massive gun, and they used to call it Anzio Annie. And I don't know what the range it was, but that 10 to 12 mile inland, it could easy cover that distance, and by God, when it went off, it went off. No matter where you were. But, yes, we did the landing there, and with the medical for a while, and put into the line with the other lads.
This is when you moved to D Company, was it?
D Company, yeah.
Had the battalion lost a lot of men, and was this the reason for that?
A lot of men, once they got to this higher ground, they were taken prisoner. They weren't all wounded casualties or anything like that. A lot were taken prisoner. And out of the battalion that went in, when we eventually got relieved, D Company, which I was in, I suppose, had the easiest part of it because we weren't surrounded. And I'd say that when we come out, the battalion strength was less than 100.
Had you been promoted at all up to this time?
Of course, at that time.
When did you get your stripes?
That was at Anzio, and I got the first one. Yeah. I suppose that'll be because of that few others left. I have to give it to somebody. And that was just the start of it. And from there, like later on in the war, it came to a sergeant. And most of the war was over by us, made sergeant.